Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up. It is Monday, November 25th. I guess that makes it exactly 1 month till Christmas.
Oh, well, you would bring that up.
But it's 20.
That was very bah humbug, Peter. My name is Magnus Thiewald, and joining me in the studio is Peter the Great.
Peter R.H.
No, it's the 27th anniversary of the APEC protests.
Ah, very interesting, here in Vancouver.
And it wouldn't be more apropos if it was 20 years, because there was a person dubbed Sergeant Pepper, yes. Sergeant Hugh Stewart. But it's 27 years ago today that Hugh Stewart used his pepper spray.
Yes. And then Nardwar, the human serviette, who is very well-known.
Yeah, put the pepper on my plate. But let me tell you.
Community radio personality from our friends over at CITR.
I was not there on the day, but I was there before and after, in the sense that Spartacus Books, they were planning it. It was called Vanarchy. See, it's a pun, Vancouver Anarchy.
Yeah.
And Jaggy Singh, the other Jaggy Singh, because the NDP leader has the same name.
Jaggy Singh was a very well-known and maybe a little bit controversial activist.
Well, I knew him. I knew him. Because the thing was, they weren't – I had some other concepts.
Yeah.
And that's why I didn't show up for two reasons. One, that I knew something bad was going to happen as such. And second was that they weren't hearing what I had to say about things. So I was there at the planning stages and afterwards. So you're going to hear true correspondence. You called me correspondent last week incorrectly, but this is retroactive correspondence.
Excellent. And is that what you were talking about later in the program?
Yes, it is.
Awesome. Okay. That'll be very interesting. It is almost also... November 25th is the first day marking 16 days against violence against women, an annual honoring paying of mind to an issue that has not gone away and continues to plague all societies around the world. And there are a number of events happening with regard to that. We have one of our correspondents, Jesse Wentzloff, down at an important conference taking place today, which is a conference sponsored by the Battered Women's Support Society, and it is a conference covering a lot of different issues, criminalization of Black, Indigenous, and women of color, key family law issues, including coercion, peace bonds, and protection orders, intersections of criminal law and protection and their effects on survivors, transformative justice approaches, strategies centering on survivors, and much more. And we're hoping to get a live report from that down there today. They're doing a press conference this morning, but it doesn't look like that's going to happen in time for this program. But I think you will, Jesse, will be bringing you more about that on tomorrow's Speak Up program. And we will be doing lots of coverage of the issues and events around the 16 days against violence against women throughout this period. So you can look forward to that more on Speak Up this week, as well as, of course, Intravenous on Wednesdays, and a whole lot more. So stay tuned for that. We have a couple of reports about things going on in our community, including a surprising amount of controversy about efforts to, or an initiative from Burnaby to create a more dedicated all-day bus lane for buses traveling along the Hastings corridor. Danny Nesrati was at the city council meeting about that last week, and there was a lot of heated discussion. So we're going to bring you his report on that in just a couple of moments. Plus, we have a report from Jesse Wentzloff about the New West Crisis Response Pilot Project that is, again, looking at issues of violence against women and how we as a society can address those. So that's going to be coming up in about 10 minutes. And of course, Peter's discussion, looking back at
the APEC protests and the inside dope about how it was organized, and then the whole afterwards, there was trouble getting the legal funds after for the half. Mm-hmm.
And that was sort of that time 27 years ago, the late 90s was, and the early 2000s was kind of the heyday of anti-globalization protests.
Well, we were on the vanguard because the Battle of Seattle was 1999.
Yeah.
So actually, we were it was the end. It was the end of 1999 that it started happening. For the United States, internationally, mm-hmm. you could say. But this was before the Battle of Seattle.
So. Yeah. So there's like APEC, and then the Battle of Seattle, and then I think a year or two later, there is a big. I think it was when it was either APEC or the G7 met in, I think it was in Montreal, wasn't it? Or was it Toronto? No, it was Toronto.
Oh.
And there was a huge, lot of protests and a huge police response.
Isn't that happened like 12 years ago or something? Or 13 years ago? No. I know what happened in the year 2000. There was a protest about the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund in Washington, D.C. in the year 2000.
Well, there is quite a lot of that activity going on. Anyway, we'll be back to talk about that towards the end of the program. First off, though, here is our reporter Danny's report on just how controversial bus lanes and eliminating parking and other things can get.
Tensions were high at the Burnaby City Council meeting on November 18th, 2024. With many on, Burnaby City Council having serious questions and concerns for a presentation that was given by TransLink that proposed improvements for the speed and reliability of the R5. Many Burnaby City Councilors took issue with the street parking that this expansion would remove. The reason given being that the local businesses along Hastings Street in the Burnaby Heights neighborhood rely on those parking spaces to accommodate their customers. After an extensive round of questions from Burnaby City Council, Burnaby Councillor Daniel Tatro was able to pass an amendment for TransLink's proposal, shortening the originally proposed expansion by 4 streets and having the city look into the feasibility of bus bulbs within the Burnaby Heights area.
I think lost in the discussion, or what we see sometimes in this divisive debate, is we miss the common goals that exist in all the interested parties. So, you know, I know talking to many transit riders, whether they're all-purpose riders or occasional riders, that they want reliable, frequent, and faster service and experience to get to where they need to go. But I also know that these transit riders, they do care about these small businesses, and they want to access these small businesses, and they do value and cherish the unique nature of the Heights. I also know that at the same time, many Burnaby residents and merchants in the area care passionately about climate change and improving transit as well, but also want to ensure that, you know, that the businesses continue to succeed and thrive. But also that the sense of strong community of the Heights feels alive, because it is a distinct feel of the Heights.
Bus bulbs serve as curb extensions that align bus stops with parking lanes, which allow buses to stop and board passengers without ever having to leave the original lane of travel. The purpose of this amendment was to maintain the street parking available in the Burnaby Heights area so as to not cause any economic impacts for local businesses. CJSF was able to speak with Dennis Agar, the executive director of Movement Metro Vancouver Transit Riders, a public transit advocacy group who had attended the meeting alongside numerous members of Movement that were in support of TransLink's original proposed expansion.
Watered down a little bit, you could consider it a compromise. But what we heard from council is that, you know, their only concern was that it impacted businesses, right? That it took away parking. But they told us that they want to do some pretty bold stuff with bus lanes as long as it doesn't impact businesses. So that, I think, really opens the door for us to get more engaged and push for things like bus lanes on Willingdon, bus lanes on Imperial, on streets that where businesses might not be affected. They really opened the door for that, and I would say especially to you know, your listeners and to SFU students to really get engaged to try and push that conversation forward.
While we were unable to receive a statement from the Burnaby Heights Merchant Association that was against this original proposal, they'd released a statement on social media about the council's decision in the days following. It reads, "We were proud that Burnaby showed that we still have a civil society where we can express ourselves and find a place of common ground and compromise. We are proud of and deeply grateful to our city council for upholding that process." Burnaby City Council's decision to amend the original proposal from TransLink ended up being a relatively popular decision, with groups both for and against the proposal being relatively satisfied with the end result. Once again, this has been Danny Nezvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. And this piece would not be possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
And I think we've heard that story many times before with bike lanes as well, when they put in bike lanes on some of the major streets in downtown Vancouver. Local residents were, or not local residents, but local businesses were very up in arms about, you know, the loss of any street parking. It'd be interesting for, you know, I'm sure, and maybe I'll look into this, you know, studies done on the effect of street parking versus for businesses in situations like this, because the proposal here was to eliminate a lot of the street parking along Hastings to make an all-day dedicated bus lane without taking up one of the traffic lanes to do that. But I know, as someone who sometimes stops in that area, you know, if you can't find parking, sometimes you just decide to go somewhere else. So it's you know, I get where they're coming from, but I guess that's why it's controversial.
What's the kind of purpose of having this extra lane for the bus?
I think to make the bus able to travel more efficiently up and down Hastings. Because if I don't know if you ever along Hastings, but it can be jammed up all day long sometimes.
Yeah, I'm a lifetime non-driver. I never learned how to drive. I'm 62 on December 9th, so yeah. It's a bit too late now to learn. But I mean, so I don't really know a lot of the issues with if you're a driver.
Right. Well, I think the logic there is that, you know, if there's a dedicated bus lane that's not full of cars, then the buses are able to get through pretty efficiently and stay on their schedule. And of course, you know, the more efficient buses and quicker buses can travel, the more appealing they are as a mode of transportation. Not to mention it makes it easier for them to stay on schedule, which is also, you know, important. That's the logic. And of course, you know, from business operators along that route, you know, they want people to be able to swing in and stop and park and run into their businesses and do some stuff and then head on. And if they don't see that available, then they're worried that they're going to lose that business.
They got quite a bit of a strip of commercial venues on in Hastings, Burnaby.
Yep.
And it kind of has a bit of a stop at when it kind of swerves around, and then you got the other safe way. There's basically two safe ways.
Yeah.
One's closer to us here, Easterner, and then they even got a bit of a strip there. But I don't know. It's sort of a bit of a trade-off of things, I guess.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're going to go to another report. This is Jesse Wentzloff's interview with about John Stark about the New West Crisis Response Pilot Project. Let's go with that, and we'll be back after this. And here we go.
John Stark, a manager of social planning. I've been with the city for 18 years. I've been extensively involved with addressing homelessness, even though the work I deal with deals with a broad range of social issues. And over the past year and a half, being involved with the Crisis Response Pilot Project, I'm really just doing a lot of research with regards to placing in a position where it can launch.
My name's Brad Davey. I'm the Deputy Fire Chief with New Westminster Fire and Rescue Services, but I've also been working with the pilot project for the last year and a half. I bring to this project my background of being a pharmacist with Fraser Health Authority and have some 30 years with that.
Great. Thanks again to both of you for being here. Can you give us a high-level overview of what is the Crisis Response Pilot Project?
The Crisis Response Pilot Project addresses the three crises of homelessness, mental health, and substance use. And we know with regards to the pandemic that all municipalities, with regards to these crises, there's been an increase. Between 2020 and 2023, based on our point-in-time homeless count, there was a 65% increase in homelessness in New Westminster. And our neighboring municipalities had similar or higher increases in homelessness. Combined with that, we have the opioid epidemic. And we also know with the pandemic that isolation became an issue. A number of faith-based and nonprofits closed their doors, just like civic facilities. And this really, for people who were dealing with mental health issues, there was definitely individuals who self-medicated to deal with this isolation and loneliness. So we saw these three crises definitely take hold. And as a municipality, we realized that the status quo couldn't continue, that if we really wanted to make progress, we couldn't just look at one crisis because we'd have limited effectiveness. We'd have to look at three because they're interrelated. We also recognized that these are senior government responsibilities, but we needed to do something in the interim as we work with the senior levels of government with regards to funding and resources. So there are three interdepartmental teams as part of the Crisis Response Pilot Project. The first is what we call a crisis response team, which is a non-clinical outreach team. And its purpose is to make connections, develop relations and trust. And that's done through trying to meet the needs of our unhoused population and those living with mental health and substance use issues. And this could be providing food, clothing items, taxi vouchers with regards to accessing services. And the whole idea for them is to make appropriate referrals to ensure that the people are getting the assistance they need. So they work with our faith-based nonprofit and provincial organizations and teams to address those issues. The other team we have is an operations support team. And this is really looking at the externalities related to the three crises. We know that businesses and residents have been impacted by these three crises. And we also recognize that when someone's impacted, they want to have a response to. So through bylaws, through fire, police, integrated services, and engineering operations and parks, they're trying to address the impacts of these three crises on residents and businesses. And we know if we can bring them on side and address their issues, they will be advocating with us with regards to trying to address these crises. And the third is what we're calling our policy and advocacy team. And this team is really important. This team is working with the senior levels of government around additional funding, resources, and services, addressing needs and gaps, and really communicating with that crisis response team and operations support team to get a sense as to what's happening on the ground and where we need to be advocating. And we have based this on extensive consultation and case study research. We looked at 9 municipalities, some of the best practices there. We met with several of the municipalities, and we did extensive consultation with health and ministry officials.
As you've described, there's a lot of moving parts there, and the whole point is that there are these three intersecting crises. How are you managing all of those different layers and their interactions?
You're right. We have a lot of moving parts, and that does make it a little bit complex, but it is a requirement. The reason being is that we need to have subject matter experts from each area in each field to address all the externalities. We're trying to address the concerns of not just those that are unsheltered, but also the businesses and the community in itself. And it is quite a complex part. John alluded to the fact how we had engaged quite a few people before we started the program. But along with that engagement, we've brought in a lot of different services to support us. And we're trying to bring a lot of different teams and support services and different agencies together to make sure that we can be effective. We realize that if we try to do this all ourselves, that we're not likely to be successful. So we do have the three different teams within the city, and those three teams are working well with the nonprofits, the faith-based organizations that are out there, provincial bodies, just about everything that you need so that you can make sure that we provide a holistic and wholesome approach to the three issues that we're trying to address and that it is fulsome.
You've both mentioned working with faith-based organizations, working with other community organizations and levels of government. I want to ask both, this crisis is not unique to New Westminster. It is something that is affecting municipalities across the country, around the continent and the world, but also particularly here in the Lower Mainland, all the other municipalities. So on the one hand, what is unique about the circumstances in New Westminster? And also, how do you work with or learn from or in other ways collaborate with other municipalities surrounding New Westminster?
The most unique part, I think, is our approach. One of the first things that we did is we looked at some of the literature that is out there. And as John has already said, we looked at all the other municipalities. We're not actually copying what anybody else has done. Instead, we're trying to cherry pick the approaches from the other different municipalities that are working. And then we have quite an active program involved to try to make sure that we engage everybody so that we can be iterative in our approach and that we can adjust to identify any gap that's being missed or anything that we need to engage or to include anybody in that could be affected by these crises so that they have a voice to point us in the right direction if we need to improve anything. You know, we have some working groups involved with the program to inform the project, and we've set up some focus groups to try and inform the project to make sure that we don't miss anything and to make sure that we're including everybody that we should be including. I don't know if you want to add to that, John.
Like I stated, I think one of the strengths of this is not to look at the one crisis, because a lot of municipalities are looking at homelessness, but really to look at in conjunction with the three, because we know that mental health and substance use are contributing factors to homelessness, and that these three crises are interrelated. So taking a more holistic approach and looking at them in combination, I think we'll have a lot more success. Just at some of the things we're looking at additional supportive housing in complex care beds, because we know that emergency shelters are not a long-term solution. And in a lot of cases, there's not even adequate emergency shelter capacity. So a big part of this is really compiling information, making a case that these are the needs and gaps. And this is how many supportive housing units we have, and working with the senior levels of government and trying to allay some of their concerns. Sometimes senior levels of government are concerned because there's opposition within communities with regard to supportive housing and other interventions. So by working with our business community and residents and addressing their needs, we're hoping to bring them on side and be part of that advocacy with regards to addressing these crises and looking at longer term solutions around supportive housing. We're looking at an inhalation component, because we know we do have an overdose prevention site, but it only addresses the needs of injection drug users and not those who inhale the drugs. And about 65 to 70% of people are inhaling their drugs now. So by having an inhalation component, that will bring people who are on a street inside. That also addresses business and resident concerns. So that's why we're trying to look at this. We need to be looking at this holistically, but also looking at the different sectors and how we can work together. We don't want a situation where it's happened in other municipalities where a supportive housing project is put forth and residents and businesses are actively campaigning against it. So we see that this is why we're taking such efforts to involve both businesses and residents, including on working groups.
Yeah, that scenario you laid out where a supportive housing project or another support is voted down by community members does seem to be a recurring story. What would you say to residents who are against this sort of thing or who might think that if you provide these extra resources, you might attract more unhoused people to come take advantage of such resources?
Well, I will say it's interesting. Our unhoused population is not as transient as people think. Every 3 years is a point in time homeless count. And based on that count, the most recent count, which was March 2023, 63% of the individuals had lived in New Westminster for over 1 year, and 43% had lived in New Westminster for 6+ years. In a lot of cases, we also have evidence from other municipalities where there are very limited resources like Chilliwack, Abbotsford, Maple Ridge, where they have large homeless encampments. And very few services. And people have both informal and formal support networks, and they're less transient. And I think with regards to businesses, we have to realize if we're bringing people inside, whether that's a 24/7 emergency shelter or that supportive housing, those individuals are not sheltering in parks and business alcoves and doorways, open burning to keep warm or to cook, discarding belongings. They have access to toilets, which they may not have. So really, in a lot of ways, it's addressing some of the externalities or issues which they're concerned about. And I think we have to change the conversation around that. And part of that is through, that's why RIA is on board with regards to communication. It's trying to work with the community and bring them on side that not doing anything is not an option anymore, that we need to do something and that this will have positive impacts. It may take some time, but it will have positive impacts. And enforcement is also not a solution because it just moves the issue from one area to another. And the courts have stated that people are allowed to shelter overnight in public places. So we do have to look at longer term strategies.
I also wonder if either of you can touch on the importance of using trauma-informed, culturally sensitive principles to navigate these crises and how the group is going about that.
So I did reference the point in time homeless count, and what's interesting about that is based on that count, 3.1% of our population self-identifies Indigenous in New Westminster, but 43% of our unsheltered population self-identifies Indigenous in New Westminster. We also noticed a discrepancy between our unsheltered and our sheltered population, 12% sheltered self-identifies Indigenous versus 43% unsheltered, which raised questions for us is why we're individuals not seeking shelter. And we suspect that those shelters are not culturally appropriate or not meeting their needs. So we really need to rethink with regards to the facilities and services addressing their needs. The other thing we found out in that point in time homeless count that of those who are unhoused and self-identify as Indigenous, 58%, either they or a family member, had experienced residential schools. So there may be a mistrust of government-funded services and institutional-like settings. So sometimes when we think of shelters, sometimes we have rows of beds. And we have to really look at that and also with how we interact with individuals. And I'll turn that over to Brad to get a little bit more around our cultural, culturally appropriate response here.
Yeah, so it's both. It's making sure that you're culturally appropriate for the Indigenous, but also making sure that you're trauma-informed in your approach for anybody that's using substance use, whether they're Indigenous or not. Both of these populations have had a long history of mistrust in government agencies and maybe haven't necessarily always been treated the best way that they should be or a way that's appropriate for the conditions they're in. And maybe we haven't always been sensitive to what they've experienced, and even healthcare hasn't taken the best approaches. By trying to make sure that our staff and everybody that's engaged in these populations understand the trauma-informed approach and understand culturally appropriateness, we're hoping to build some connections that are meaningful and that can lead to patients opening up, and building a trust in the supports that we're trying to offer them or that we think and that they think are appropriate for them, and collaborate with them to build a patient-centered type approach that is consensual on both sides, where they have the trust in the supports that are being offered so they will engage the supports in a meaningful way and hopefully end up with a better outcome.
And I just wanted to add there, we have engaged an Indigenous-owned and operated planning and facilitation company to inform our staff training around a crisis response team, and also to work with us as we work with the senior levels of government around new facilities, services, and supports to ensure that they're more culturally appropriate and they are meeting those needs. So that is a really important piece of the work. Also, from a staff perspective, learning about the impacts of colonialism in residential schools and ensuring that